1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. It's another edition of Feldis and Kale. A delight to have you along with us, and we're proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And a new sponsor, Dan, we welcome to the show today, Weed Family Automotive.
Wonderful, wonderful family business, operating for 26 years. We take our cars there. Great business, and honor to have them sponsoring the show.
No doubt about that. 124 Store Street in Concord, weedfamilyautomotive.com if you want to get more information. And Rob Werner is our guest on this portion of Feldis and Kale. And Dan, why don't you do the honors of introducing Rob to our Feldis and Kale audience?
Well, Rob Werner is the state director for League of Conservation Voters, and League of Conservation Voters just does tremendous work on energy policy, energy efficiency, conservation, environmental protection. Rob does amazing grassroots work and policy work here in the state, and has been central to a lot of the progress that we have made on energy efficiency and community solar, on you name it, environmental protection issues. And so Rob is a great advocate and grassroots organizer, and it's great to have him on the show. And he's a friend, and a friend to all of us who care about the environment. So, Rob, how are you this morning?
I'm great, Dan. Looks like we're over the rain. Sun's coming out. I have some friends, actually some family and friends down in New Orleans and out west in Lake Tahoe that I'm concerned about, given our extreme weather that we've had. But at least we have the sun here today.
We sure do. And the sun is shining on those folks who like to invest in infrastructure. What about that segue? That was pretty good, right, Ken and Rob?
That was
very good.
Have you been working on that, Dan?
I just came up with it.
Oh, okay. Wow.
That's pretty snazzy. But Rob, can you give our listeners an update on the infrastructure bill that is making its way through down in Washington, D.C., Senator Hassan and Senator Shaheen were key players on negotiating it. And what are the aspects of it with respect to coastal resiliency, environmental protection, et cetera?
Well, you know, there's actually two parts to this whole play that's being made in Washington around serious investments in infrastructure, including resiliency for climate and clean energy. So the infrastructure bill passed the Senate, as you know, very bipartisan, 67 votes, I believe. So it is now in the House. And what's in the bill is something, a whole variety of things that are very significant, not only for roads and bridges, that's sort of what we think of as traditional infrastructure. That's obviously very important because we have not made these investments. These need an investment for decades in this country with our roads and bridges, and we certainly are, and our airports and ports as well. So we really need to do this for our own international competitiveness, certainly. On the climate and clean energy side, one of the things that's in the what we call the bipartisan infrastructure bill is grid modernization, funds for that, because, you know, as we move to electrify everything, which is certainly what we're going to have to do, we need to upgrade the capacity of our electric grids around the country to take that extra and extra power as it's generated. So that's certainly a big need. Electric vehicle infrastructure, charging stations, that is certainly a feature that's in the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And it's interesting, you know, in the private sector, you have companies both in Europe and now in the United States that are making significant moves towards EV infrastructure and EV vehicles. You know, Ford has announced that they expect that they will be making much larger investments, majority of investments in electric vehicles as compared to their traditional combustion engine investments by 2023. So that's right around the corner. You've seen, you know, Ford rolling out its Mustang, its EV Mustang, its F-150 electric, which is getting a lot of interest. So we have a lot of activity in the private sector, but we're going to have to make significant investments in the country around EV infrastructure. And here in New Hampshire, as I think we might have talked about before, we're a bit behind our neighbors in New England and Canada as well in terms of the infrastructure. So those funds are really going to be helpful here.
Yeah, and I see in the $1 trillion package, I should say, seeing it broken down here into charging stations and chargers, and until we can convert to a higher percentage of electric vehicles in this country, and specifically here in New Hampshire, we need that that infrastructure. So there is, I believe, $7.5 billion in the $1 trillion infrastructure package devoted to the vehicle chargers.
That's right, and there'll be additional, I think, investments in EV infrastructure and incentives that are being talked about in what we call the Build Back Better plan, which is the plan that is sometimes also called the Reconciliation Plan, in terms of working its way through the Senate and the House later this fall. So that's a whole nother bucket of investments, and it's a much larger package, obviously, but it also includes significant policy changes. One of the most significant things that package will have is a clean energy standard for the country. So, New Hampshire and many other states have renewable energy portfolios laws, which basically require utilities to require a certain amount of produce and deliver a certain amount of renewable energy in their energy mix. That's state by state, but I think it was really key to have that as a national standards. That's important.
Certainly. And as you mentioned, Rob, Hampshire's a bit behind both in renewable portfolio standards, also electric vehicle charging infrastructure. You and I have worked together on energy efficiency, advancing that, advancing community solar. So low to middle income manufactured home parks can have ground mounted solar arrays in their parks to community choice aggregation, huge issue that is moving forward to allow municipalities the opportunity to invest in solar savings and to aggregate their bills and their purchasing power, which will reduce bills for everybody. But we're behind the eight ball on a bunch of stuff, including the charging stations, as you mentioned. And Rob, for folks listening, can you give them up to speed? There was a lawsuit, multi-state lawsuit against Volkswagen and a settlement, and New Hampshire has received settlement monies. However, it hasn't fully deployed some of those monies to electric vehicle charging infrastructure, which is one of the purposes of it. Can you give folks a little bit of update about the background on that lawsuit and where things are at here in New Hampshire in terms of the charging stations?
Well, under that settlement, states were allowed to use up to 15% of their award to help build charging stations, EV charging stations. And although Governor Sununu had taken advantage of that, as you point out, that money has not been deployed. I think what we're really hoping is that as the Energy Department got some struggles now in terms of getting up and running the new Energy Department that was enacted as part of the state budget. But that is now, I think, more under the roof of that agency, and we're hopeful that a focus can come onto that. Really, it's about, making it a priority. Unfortunately, moving that money has not been a particular priority over the last number of years. But even with that, there are things that are happening in the market, in the private sector. I point out that, the new development at XS17, that's going to include Market Basket, State Liquor Store, a number of other businesses there. The developers have done a couple of things, and we've worked with them, City of Concord and Energy Committee, to encourage this. But one of the things that's going to happen is that there are a fairly large number of charging stations that are going to be going into that development, probably 8 to 12 charging stations, and a lot of them will be fast chargers. One of the things that's interesting is that Tesla is looking at opening up their charging infrastructure to other manufacturers. I think it's a good business decision for them, because they have the fastest chargers that take the least time to charge a car. So I think that makes sense. They're going to see that there. Also, what's interesting, it's going to be the first instance where a newly built state liquor store is going to have enough solar on the roof of that building to completely offset the power needs of that building. So we're excited about that. So I think it points up that, you know, you need policy on the local, state, and federal level that's going to encourage these kinds of developments. But it's also very encouraging to see that private developers are also realizing that it is a good business decision for them, as well as a good environmental investment in our future.
So we see, Rob, the charging stations on the in the rest areas in Hooksett, but they are exclusively Tesla, correct? I mean, they're not universal chargers.
Well, they are, and I think that goes to the point that I think Tesla realizes that, you know, given their the technology that they have and their position in the market of these chargers, that you know, as I said, my understanding is that they're really looking at opening up their infrastructure to be able to be used all as a universal charger by other manufacturers. Obviously, you know, they would charge for that if anybody would, you know, buy gas as we do now.
Sure.
But I think that, you know, I think that's a really interesting development given their position in the market.
So, and now you mentioned the Exit 17 location. So would those be universal chargers available there?
Well, it's going to be a mix of Tesla and Universal, but again, you know, talking to the developers, they want to make that as available to everyone. And I think it's obviously a very good location for this kind of infrastructure. So,
yeah, no doubt about that. Now, that would be, you know, a cost to the person who has the electric car, correct?
Sure.
Yeah.
Instead of paying, you know, so much a gallon for your gas, you're going to pay to charge up your car. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that only makes sense. Rob Werner is here. Rob is the New Hampshire State Director of the League of Conservation Voters. What else can you tell us, Rob, that's going to benefit New Hampshire specifically in that $1 trillion infrastructure bill that was recently passed?
Well, there certainly is money for water infrastructure, water quality infrastructure. That's a whole other aspect of infrastructure in which we have not made the investments in the nation over the last decades that we really need to. And that covers everything from making sure that we get rid of any lead pipes that are remaining in the country. Obviously, lead has very bad health effects, particularly on children, in terms of their developmental abilities, and you know, it's really a tragedy to see what happens sometimes with lead pipes, and certainly we need to take care of that. So there's investments for that. There's also investments for wastewater treatment plants. We need to make those plants as efficient as possible, and a lot of plants around the country, including some here in New Hampshire, need upgrading. That is a public safety as well as a public health aspect that's really important. And that's every bit as important as infrastructure, as roads and highways, because it affects our public health. And then we also really need to, in addition to strengthening that kind of water infrastructure, make sure that something like a wastewater treatment plant, particularly if it's in a coastal area, is hardened, so to speak, and resilient as sea level rise comes to the fore. Because the fact of the matter is that we need everything we need to do in terms of climate change action and reducing emissions is is critically important. But there's a lot of sea level rise that's frankly baked in already that we need to deal with, and we're going to have to be resilient, and we're going to need to adapt to. So we also need to make sure that our infrastructure is hardened to the extent that we can do that in coastal areas. So there's also dollars for that.
As you mentioned, the bill has already passed in the Senate and has moved on to the House. It was done in a bipartisan fashion in the Senate. Do you see the same thing happening in the House when it comes up for a vote?
Well, I think we know that there was some back and forth between members of the Democratic caucus in the House, and there's an agreement that's been made that these infrastructure bills, both the infrastructure bill that we're talking about, what we call a bipartisan bill, and the Build Back Better plan, will be coming to the fore at the end of the month or in October. I think, those time frames are fast approaching. I know that I was just reading this morning, actually, that Speaker Pelosi has instructed all of the chairs of the House committees to resolve any differences that they have with their Senate counterparts within the next week or so. Because, with the process of committees and marking up bills, and that's when bills are actually, the details of bills are put on paper, that's called markup. That's all going to happen very quickly. And then you're going to have the Congressional Budget Office look at all of these proposals, and they're going to, quote-unquote, score it, meaning how much is this going to cost? In reality, where the revenue streams, all this detail. There's a lot of work to be done, but it is continuing apace. So I'm optimistic that at the end of the month and into October, we will see a lot of progress on this legislation, on both packages.
Hopeful, definitely hopeful, and good signs right now anyways. So in terms of the reconciliation package, Rob, the budget basically has, as you mentioned, a clean energy standard national in it. Do you know the details of what is going to be proposed in terms of that?
That is actually being worked on now. There's a lot of what has happened is that the Senate when they passed that bill, they produced a framework.
Right.
And so that framework is now really being worked on in terms of what's the actual detail, legislative language, and there's a lot of stakeholders that are involved in this process at the moment. So I'm hoping to see much more detail, towards the end of the month. But we'll keep an eye on that.
That's just a reason to have you back on Feltus and Kale.
Right.
No doubt about that. So just for the uninitiated, Rob, and I know you guys follow this very closely, and lots of us do. But now there is the $1 trillion infrastructure that did pass in the Senate is now moving on to the House, but there's also the Build Back Better plan, which is an entirely different bill.
As is the reconciliation package. That is the second part of the act here. Yeah,
and that is a more a costlier bill than the infrastructure bill.
Yeah, it was originally it's been proposed at about $3.5 trillion. We'll see where that final number ends up and what the revenue streams are to support it. That's all being worked on. But that bill includes a lot of what we call human infrastructure, as well as the climate and energy aspects that we're talking about. So, again, it's a whole nother range of investments as a society that many people are supportive of. As a matter of fact, these packages and these kinds of investments, even as large as they are, have wide public support. We at the League of Conservation Voters are working to make sure that our congressional representatives really are supported, and that they realize and that they continue to realize and know that voters in New Hampshire and New Hampshire citizens really want them to be ambitious as possible in these times, because these times really demand that.
Rob Werner, our guest. Rob, the New Hampshire State Director of the League of Conservation Voters. It's Feldis and Kale at 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers and Weed Family Automotive. 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Feldis and Kale. Presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers, and our new sponsor as of this program, Weed Family Automotive, serving the Concord area for 26 years at 124 Store Street. Our guest, Rob Werner. Rob, the New Hampshire State Director of the League of Conservation Voters. Rob, just tell us a little bit about the league itself and who is involved in it, and if someone is interested in getting involved in it, how does that take place?
Well, thanks. So, League of Conservation Voters is a national organization. We've been around for 51 years now. We were one of the original organizations that organized the first Earth Day in 1970. And so our headquarters is in Washington, D.C. We have operations in almost 40 states around the country, including a very robust program here in New Hampshire. We have 10 full-time staff. We have two offices, one in Manchester, one in Portsmouth. And we really engage in the legislature in Concord, also work very closely with our congressional representatives, all four of our members in the New Hampshire, in the Congress, and the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. And we do a lot of events. We really want to make sure that folks have opportunities to engage and to learn about the impacts of climate here in New Hampshire and around the country and also internationally, and what folks can do to advocate for the kinds of investments and actions that we need for climate change action, and making sure that we have a strong clean energy future that's not only take care of the planet but produce economic benefits and jobs for people.
And certainly you've done that without question here at the state level, having served in the state Senate for 6 years on the Energy Committee. In those 6 years and as majority leader, I can tell you that you made a huge impact on energy policy in the state of New Hampshire, and grateful for all that you've done. And so as you look forward in the state elections, how do you think things look coming up with this next legislative session? Of course, House Bill 315 was passed and signed, so, as well as Senate Bill 91, which are good improvements in terms of net metering and in terms of community choice aggregation, building off what we passed previously. But what do you see in the next legislative session on energy policy here in the state of New Hampshire? There's a lot to do. What do you see on the horizon?
Well, let me first talk about the net metering bill that you mentioned. So that is a victory. So here in Concord, for example, we're getting ready to release an RFP that will ask for bids to build a 5-megawatt system on our cap landfill on Old Turnpike Road. We also are looking at other sites around the city for additional renewable energy. We are certainly very interested and engaged in the discussion around community power that will be coming before the Concord City Council before the end of the year. So that's really positive, not only for Concord, but many municipalities around the state. I think you'll see a lot of projects being built and a lot of interest in companies. So that now, again, not only has a good environmental impact, but a good economic development and jobs impact. So we're really happy to see that. I guess for this upcoming session, there are things that were discussed, a couple bills that were retained. One of them has to do with reducing our renewable portfolio standard, which is already well behind in terms of what our projections are, compared to our New England neighbors. That bill will be coming back. I don't think we need to be working to reduce our requirements there. So we're certainly going to be making sure that the extent we can that that bill does not pass. I think with the community power and the some of the battery storage bills, Senator Waters' bill, and the net metering, I think that this coming session is going to be mostly defensive in my mind in terms of trying to make sure that we don't backslide. And we'll see what happens in the elections in 2022 and where what kind of legislature and governor we have in 2023. So, you know, we're looking forward to working with communities to make sure that they can take advantage of that net metering bill and move ahead and do good things. But I see a lot of defense in this next session.
In terms, Rob, of environmental awareness here in New Hampshire, how do we compare and how do we stack up against, you know, other states, especially states that are similar to ours in terms of climate and other considerations?
Well, if you mean by awareness, how does awareness translate into what I see as good policy, we're behind, certainly Massachusetts, Maine, and Vermont. But at the same time, I think you're increasingly seeing a lot of impact that are coming more and more to the fore in people's minds. You know, recently we had an event earlier this week around looking ahead to the impact on winter sports and winter tourism. And, you know, you have folks that are involved in those industries that are concerned over the long term. What is that going to mean for our culture, for those kinds of industries in terms of our less snowy and colder winters, those kinds of things. We've certainly seen a lot of impact with our moose population. We see more frequent and powerful storms. We see more heat. So I think people are much more sensitive and understanding of what the impacts of climate change are in this state on a practical level, and that is translating to a lot more support in terms of we understand what's going on. We need to do something about it, and we need to support policy and policymakers that will do something about these issues.
Rob, we just have a couple minutes left. What would be your message to listeners who, you know, want to get involved, want to have their voice heard, want to be more active and engaged in environmental and energy policy?
Raise your voice. Make sure that
loudly.
That your state legislators know that you have concerns and you want them to support these kinds of investments. Our own organization, you can visit lgv.org to learn more about what we're doing and what we're doing in New Hampshire and around the country. But there are many other organizations, whether it be the Forest Society or the Nature Conservancy, Sierra Club, Conservation Law Foundation. We're blessed here in New Hampshire to actually have a lot of very good organizations, and we work well together. We collaborate. But we're all really trying to create a better future for our citizens, a more secure future, a environmentally secure future, a clean energy future that's going to be better for them. And so just get involved. Raise your voice. Don't be shy. Our legislators want to hear from you.
Rob, we appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, Ken and Dan.
Thank you so much, Rob. Take care.
Rob Werner, Rob, the state director of the League of Conservation Voters here in the Granite State. Great to have Rob with us at 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, Feldis and Kale. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And we add a new sponsor today, Weed Family Automotive, serving the Concord area for 26 years at 124 Store Street, weedfamilyautomotive.com. We will take a break and return with more right here on New Hampshire Talk Radio WKXL. 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com, Feldis and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotions and your local New Hampshire Dairy Farmers, and now Weed Family Automotive of Concord. And we welcome to the program, we welcome back after seemingly a long hiatus, the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion, and that would be Amy Hall. Amy, we missed you.
Missed you, Amy.
I missed you, too, as well. Crazy busy, but I understand Stephen pitched a hit for me last week, and he did a good job. No?
Stephen Nelson was terrific. Not that I'm, you know, he didn't really entice me to try any of the obstacles at his great place in Franklin, but he was a great guest and very informative, and I'm certainly going to visit. Whether I try an obstacle or not remains a question, but I will visit.
I think you can do it, Ken.
Yeah,
you can do it.
Yeah,
and you can overcome those obstacles.
With chocolate milk, anything is possible, Dan Feltus.
That's true.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. You know, I've been up there, and, you know, I've toured that course. I tried a couple obstacles, the ones that I thought were going to be easy, but there's not a single one up there that's easy, I'll tell you that much. But it's an impressive location, an impressive organization, and just wonderful people. So thank you guys so much for chatting with him and helping your listeners learn a little bit more about health, fitness, and how chocolate milk integrates into all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. He was terrific. So today, Dan, our mission with Amy today is to debunk some of the myths involving dairy products. And, you know, a myth, according to the dictionary, is a widely held but false belief of ideas, or idea, I should say. Amy, start debunking for us.
Let's debunk away.
Okay, sure. Well, there are so many as it relates to the dairy industry, and I know we have some limited time here today, and we all know how much I can talk. I'll try to keep it limited to maybe the top three or four. But, you know, we live in a world now where the average person, believe it or not, is six generations removed from how their food is produced. I'll give you an example. My grandfather was already two generations removed, but he still had a relatively working knowledge of agriculture and how things work. Well, as things tend to move on generation after generation, we get used to shopping in the grocery store, not having to ask questions, and not having these hands-on experiences. It becomes really difficult to decipher the fact from the fiction. And there's really not a lot of people, specifically in urban areas, that have ever toured a dairy farm or that really even know a real dairy farmer. So that's sort of an unfortunate part of the reality. And what makes these myths so easy to begin and then so easy to spread? So before I get into, you know, the top myths that sort of drive me nuts and the ones that the dairy industry has to fight so progressively, is this is why it's important to talk to real dairy farmers, the things I'm going to review today. So for an example, Dan Weed, here's a perfect, perfect reference. You're going to talk to Dan about issues you have with your car. You're not going to talk to me. You're not going to talk to Dan about the dairy industry. You'll talk to me. So I hope that makes sense. Same with dentists, same with doctors. So please, if you have questions about the industry, feel free to reach out to your local dairy farmer. Nobody knows more about dairy farming than a dairy farmer. So, having gotten that all out of the way, let's
Geez, I was going to ask you about my carburetor today, Amy.
I guess
I'll have to put that off.
Problem with my tire.
I'm sorry, what's a carburetor?
I don't know. That's what I was going to ask you.
Hey, Ken, just put some chocolate milk in it. It'll
right,
be fine.
There you go.
I read once a blog that carburetors are very, very dangerous, and they could actually know. Just kidding. So we're going to go ahead. Let's start with organic milk. I am a huge fan of both conventional and organic milk. And when I first started this job, I had an impression that organic milk was a healthier choice. It was a better choice, not only for human consumption, but in the way that cows are treated. What I've come to learn is that the difference between conventional and organic milk is the marketing. All dairy farmers, here's the fact, they care about their cows. they are all treated with tremendous love and tremendous respect, given the utmost care. There is no nutritional difference, not a single ounce of nutritional difference between organic milk and conventional milk. You'll hear a lot, well, you know, organic farms don't use pesticides or they don't treat their cows with antibiotics. Some of that is true, yes. But what people need to understand is there are 40 USDA-approved pesticides that organic farmers can use. Organic farmers know they don't use antibiotics specifically on their cows. They use alternative methods. But in the conventional world of dairy, antibiotics don't end up in your milk anyway. It's illegal regardless if you give your cows antibiotics to get better or not. Pesticides in milk also doesn't happen, also illegal. So it's basically a difference in farming practices. And land base basically is one of the largest differences between a conventional farm and an organic farm. So organic farms are required to have a certain amount of land per cow so that they can graze on grass more frequently than, let's say, a conventional farm who doesn't have the land base to allow 100 cows to roam. So to come full circle with the difference between organic and conventional, nutritionally, it is 0% different. In terms of cow care, comfort, and treatment, both farms, both operations love and care for their cows. They have no choice. It's their livelihood. So those are really, it's a practice difference. It's not a nutritional difference, and it's not a care level difference. So I hope all of that sort of helps people wade through the, what makes something different than the other in the world of dairy? Well, organic and conventional, that's the difference. Very, very little difference there, other than the price tag.
So regular milk is just as healthy as organic milk. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The same essential 13 now. We'll get into this next week. Science has now announced that instead of just 9 vitamins and nutrients, it's actually 13 essential vitamins and nutrients in milk. So we've had dietitians doing some more research on the benefits of dairy, but that's not a today discussion. But yes, both organic and conventional milk contain all of the same essential nutrients, vitamins, and minerals that you need to be healthy. Absolutely. No different.
So there is a myth out there, and I believe it's a myth, that only whole milk contains vitamin D.
No, you know what's funny is that milk has 3 ingredients, real milk, cow's milk, obviously, vitamin D, and sometimes vitamin A is added to that. Vitamin D is fortified and actually added to milk. Huh? What that does is 2 things. It helps children who are vitamin D deficient. Helps women who are traditionally very vitamin D deficient, men as well, but the 2 segments that we really want to focus on are women and children in that area. So we do add, the dairy industry does add vitamin D to it. So it also, what a lot of people don't know, is vitamin D helps a little bit with the absorption of calcium that is in the milk. So it's a great vitamin in there, and it's only 1 of 3 ingredients that it is in whole natural milk. It is also in 1% milk. It can be added to skim milk and 2% milk. So it's not just whole milk.
Okay, so you've debunked yet another myth, another milk myth.
This is a debunkathon.
Yes, it is. It is.
It is. Well, I love Dan's one-liners. Dan, I love you.
I love you too.
That's awesome.
Well,
what was the one we used 2 weeks ago? I would write it down, but you came up with the best one.
Hang on, Amy, because I know people want to get some kind of writing utensil here to jot this down, and Dan is one of them. So we're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and debunk more milk myths right here. Feldis and Kale at 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers and Weed Family Automotive. Welcome back. 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. It is Feldis and Kale, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers and Weed Family Automotive of Concord. Amy Hall with us, the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion. We are debunking myths surrounding milk today. And Amy, continue.
Okay. Well, not just milk, dairy in general.
Dairy in general, yes.
Yes, it tends to circulate. The newest term that we're starting to recognize in the dairy industry is something that people have pegged GMO milk, right? So genetically modified organisms, right? So here's the thing. Regardless of what a cow is fed, that does not make the milk GMO. Absolutely not. So there is no traditional or nutritional difference, again, with organic versus conventional, between GMO and non-GMO fed cows. So it's kind of like saying you get chocolate milk from a cow if you feed it chocolate syrup. It doesn't work that way. And I guess that's the best, most simplest way that I could explain it. And that's how it works. And again, GMO milk or non-GMO milk, much like organic versus conventional, it's just a marketing label. You know, if you label something GMO-free, what are you going to assume about the other products not labeled that? That actually GMO milk exists? Well, that's just not the case. That's not the way it works.
All right. So another dairy myth debunked. We're just knocking them off here, Amy, right and left.
I know. There's so many. So many we wouldn't even have time to get to. The other big one, we've discussed antibiotics, and I feel good that we've debunked that one fairly repetitively, and I think people now understand that milk cannot legally contain antibiotics. It can't. It's illegal. Do not worry. Whatever you pick up in the grocery store aisle that is milk, it does not contain antibiotics.
Right.
A dairy farmer would be put out of business immediately just in federal fines alone. It's not worth it. The big one here, the next big one next to antibiotics is, of course, hormones. So in terms of growth hormones, those, number one, wouldn't be used in dairy cows to begin with, especially considered that dairy cows are used for milk. They're not traditionally meat cows. So there's no need to fatten up a cow that isn't going to go to a meat or beef market. It just doesn't make sense. So BST is a hormone that cows naturally have that helps them produce milk. So we'll break this down again simply. You know, women who give birth to a child and they breastfeed, there's a certain hormone that they produce that allows them to do that. And it's a natural hormone that they don't, that's not engineered, if you will. And in terms of anything you eat, whether it be seafood or beef, or dairy, let's say you're a vegan and you're on a plant-based diet, soy, if you can name anything that lives, it contains hormones. There is no such thing as hormone-free food. So the idea that cows are in the barn or out in the fields and dairy producers are out there pumping them full of hormones to make them produce more milk, or that your milk even contains artificial hormones, is also, it's just not the case. So people can feel good that, one, now you know that anything you pick up in the grocery store is going to contain hormones because it's food. And number two, milk is no different in that, yes, it contains hormones, but they're natural, just like the vitamins and minerals contained therein.
I'll tell you, Amy, this has been quite an informative session. It really and truly
Absolutely.
Is. Now, what about when I drink, or Dan drinks, or anybody drinks chocolate milk, or you know, any kind of flavored milk, coffee, strawberry, whatever it might be? Is that as healthy as just regular whole milk?
Well, it depends, because there's added sugar,
yeah,
right, in flavored milk. So, you know, let's say that, you know, you have diabetes or you have issues regulating your blood sugar or glucose. Is flavored milk with sugar in it as healthy? No, not on the sugar end of things. But I will say this, is that flavored milk, again, I keep going back to organic versus conventional. Adding flavor does not take away essential vitamins, nutrients, or minerals. So in that sense, yes, when you pick up that bottle of chocolate milk It's not missing calcium because it's been flavored. It's not missing niacin because it's been flavored. The only alteration to a flavored milk is, in fact, that flavoring. And oftentimes that flavoring does contain sugar.
Sure.
So no, nutritionally, absolutely no difference there either.
All right. Amy Hall, Granite State Dairy Promotion, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks, Amy.
Oh, thank you guys so, so much. You have a great rest of your week.
You too. Feldis and Kale, 1039-1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com.